Hey, hello everybody. Welcome to this APA Real-Time Auto Intelligence Update. I'm Jamie Butters, Vice President of the Automotive Press Association. I'm also Executive Editor of Automotive News and host of the Daily Drive podcast. This is our second or third real-time update during the Trump tariff times. We're going to be looking at the impacts of President Trump's tariffs and the outlook for the year. It's a very timely discussion. The president just dialed back the auto tariffs, GM set new guidance, and April sales results are trickling in from those still brave enough to share them. Before we get too far along, I want to make sure to thank our sponsors. We've got Ford, GM, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Lucid, Nissan, Subaru, Stellantis, and Toyota. We really appreciate them. They keep the APA in good fiscal health so we can serve the working press and through them serve the public and the industry. We've got some great events coming up on May 16th. We're having a panel discussion with MEMA's Colin Shaw, Paul McCarthy, and Mike Jackson. June 4th, John Murphy breaks down the Car Wars product pipeline report. But first, we're really going to serve the news media with a happy hour on May 8th. We'll be toasting the careers and celebrating the retirements of several recent board members: Rod Maloney, Patrick Morrissey, Bob Gritzinger, Sean Morgan, and Ben Clayman. If you want to go and you aren't an APA member, check out this next slide. You can send an email or call Kevin. You can text him anytime. Trust me, I do it day and night. I would also point you toward our website, automotivepressassociation.net. And one last little bit of housekeeping. Don't forget to give credit to the APA. Good journalists always give credit, and we ask that you include the context in which it is given, namely that you heard it on a webinar or a live stream hosted or conducted by the APA, by the Automotive Press Association. Spell it all out if you would, please. I trust you to word it your own way, though. All right, now that everyone is logged in, let's get to the good stuff. I'm glad to bring you our special guest for today, Jonathan Smoke, Chief Economist for Cox Automotive, and Aaron Keating, Executive Analyst at Cox Automotive. Cox Automotive, of course, is the umbrella group of auto-related companies under Cox Enterprises. It includes brands such as Kelley Blue Book, Auto Trader, and Manheim, the auto auction giant. We welcome your questions. Please put them in the chat. But first, Jonathan, I believe you're going to start us off with just a small number of slides to set the stage.
Well, actually, I'm going to give that courtesy to our Chief Tariff Impact Officer, Aaron Keating, because that's what we're all here for, and that's what we're going to lead off with.
Right on.
Absolutely. Next slide. Hi, everybody. Good to see you all. So we all know that April 29th came, and May 3rd is yet to be here, and we still don't know if there's anything additional coming out between now and Saturday, but our presumption is that there isn't, this might be the last we hear before May 3rd tariffs come into play. But to talk about a little bit about what happened yesterday and how the industry should be thinking about it. So what has changed to date? Mostly the stacking tariffs have been eliminated. It is not completely that way because there are still tariffs on Chinese goods that are coming over that will be stacked. So there's some complexity still to it. It's a little bit of a flow chart you've got to follow to see, follow your path to find out what your tariff situation is going to be. But for the most part, the steel and aluminum stacking is coming off, and then the IEEPA imposed tariffs will also come off. Now, granted, those were already exempted, at least for USMCA compliant vehicles. Those were exempted so far. So that's not necessarily an additive effect, but it's now completely obliterated or taken off for now from the stacking effect. There was no mention of the 10% reciprocal tariff stacking baseline and country specific rates. So we'll assume that that is the same where the automotive tariffs do not stack on reciprocal tariffs. There is a new offset, and it's important just to understand the difference here. So the tariff is staying in place. Anyone who is importing the specific automotive parts that were identified in Annex 1 will still be held accountable to pay the 25% tariff on those goods when they cross into our borders. What has been allowed is a proclamation stating that all automakers who assemble their vehicles in the US may claim up to a 3.75% offset on the average aggregated MSRP of the vehicles that are assembled in the US. So technically, when that has been delivered in the proclamation directly from the president, he means to say, look, if you have produced a car that has 85% content on it from the US as well as USMCA compliant parts, then essentially we've given you a break there. And in the first year, you aren't paying a tariff. It's not that you're not paying the tariff, you're paying it. You are coming up with the financing upfront to pay that tariff as the goods cross the border. You will just be allowed to apply for an offset. And that offset theoretically should wipe out, quote unquote, your expense for the tariff if you've got 85% content with US and USMCA approved. It is not applying to suppliers directly. There has been some mention about how automakers can apply this or transfer it or defer it to their suppliers. There's no real clarity on exactly how that would happen. And it does not excuse anyone else nor offer an offset for anyone else who may be importing parts, which significantly may and still impact repair, maintenance, and other types of importers of parts that are coming in. And so this still will impact everybody. There is just a specific offset for automakers. And again, potentially some of their suppliers to be determined at some time how that actually works out. The implementation guidance is still unclear. The Federal Register, as we were just looking at before we hopped on this call, has an unpublished version of the proclamation there. Strangely, it is published. It is on the Federal Register. You can see it, but it is called the unpublished version. So feel free to peruse those 9 pages of dialogue there to see the order in which all of the different proclamations have been made. What has not changed again is that there is still a 25% tariff on any imported vehicles, and approximately 50% of the market, as we see it, still has significant risk. We have heard lots of announcements of some production coming back into the U.S., but there's been no concrete numbers on how that might offset. So are we up to 60%, you know, U.S. made vehicles and 40% imported? We don't have details yet on that. Again, what as I said earlier, it's unclear if the May 3rd tariffs are going to, well, it's not unclear whether they will, you know, impact repair service, but it's unclear whether they will still go through. We anticipate that they are. We anticipate that this was the big move that was made ahead of the May 3rd deadline, but it's not necessarily clear on how that may change in the next 48 hours. Stay tuned. We might see you back here tomorrow. And then, you know, the other 2 points that we like to just continue to point out, tariffs are inherently inflationary for the automotive market. Jonathan's going to go through some details here in the next few slides about how we're looking at that. And uncertainty persists. I think everyone's been checking in to whatever quarterly calls have been made, and we continue to hear automakers and all other manufacturers that are working in the United States talk about how they're unclear and not able to provide full guidance for the rest of the year. So the uncertainty persists, and this, of all things, is what we're most concerned about. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to my esteemed boss, Jonathan Smoke, to take you through our details of how things have unfolded so far.
Well, thank you, Aaron. And I totally agree that uncertainty persists, and all we can say really about this that's been touted as a reprieve is that it's just taking a bad situation and making it slightly less worse. It's not good. It is more inflation to come that, frankly, from my perspective, looks worse than the tariffs on imported vehicles for the broader economy. But while the industry and consumers deal with these new details and the negative impacts, let's take a look at what has happened in April as the first round of tariffs starting to impact the market and the economy really started to bite. So the soft data, like consumer sentiment data shown here, indicate a very wary customer. Every measure of consumer sentiment has shown declines this year, and especially over the last 100 days. We prefer the daily measure from Morning Consult because it's daily and its base is much larger and much more likely to be accurately reflecting what's really happening as you make comparisons over time. We track it every day because in normal times, high and increasing sentiment is highly correlated with vehicle sales. So when the consumer is worried about the future, they are less likely to make major purchase decisions. And now we've seen consumers be more negative since the pandemic and the declines in 2021 and 2022 didn't really keep them from spending back then. But the declines then were more about COVID and inflation. And the situation, which I'll argue is very different today than then, we had lots of supportive spending. We had a strong labor market, favorable to workers, record low interest rates, and loose credit. Consumers have none of those advantages today and yet face higher prices, not just on vehicles, but on many goods in the economy. So if you go to the next slide, we can see what the expectation of higher prices to come has led to, and it's led to a surge in sales as consumers rush to buy before vehicles are completely impacted by the tariffs that have already announced and gone into play. So prior to the March 26th announcement on tariffs on imported vehicles, we were seeing seasonally strong, but what I would call normal patterns for tax refund season in both the new and the used market. After the March 26th announcement, we saw an acceleration in sales in both new and used that looked very similar to the patterns that we had indeed back in the spring of 2021, when it was clear that a supply chain problem was emerging. However, unlike in 2021, that frenzy couldn't even last for the whole month of April, it would appear in our data. In the new market, we have seen sales increase each week, but the pace of increase has been slowing, especially in the back half of April. Yes, sales are strong. They're running up approximately, in our latest estimates, up 21% year over year in the new vehicle market. But the slowing pace of increase suggests that we may just be at the peak and possibly even starting the other side of that peak. In the used market, we're also seeing strong gains year over year of about 15%. But the increase week over week has definitely ended there. It looks like the market has hit a ceiling, and I would argue that it has, and that ceiling is tight supply and higher prices. So unlike in 2021, the consumer is unable and unwilling to continue buying cars at quote-unquote any price. The industry and the White House are about to get a lesson in what economists call price elasticity, and we can talk about that if we have interest in it. So if you go to the next slide, our Vauto data clearly shows that supply has tightened substantially, especially over the last 5 weeks. If you focus on the new market, you see that strange blip, and you saw it on the prior slide in sales and supply. Well, just for a second to explain, that wasn't really real last year. It was the impact of the cyber attack that disrupted dealers' ability to update their inventory and sales data. What was really happening last year was that days supply normalized and was fairly consistent all year long at a level in our data that was about 80 to 85 days of supply throughout the year on a fairly consistent basis. That aligned with inventory on lots for dealers of about 3 million units. Well, we're already down to less than 2.6 million units now this spring, with deliveries being cut by some of the importers and with the surge in sale. So day supply is down even more than we see in just the basic inventory levels to just ahead of 60 days. We could easily get back to 2022 levels of day supply very soon. And by soon, I mean within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And remember that going forward, all of the inventory refreshes that we see over the next several weeks will be vehicles that are exposed to tariffs. First, the tariffs on imports, which is nearly half, but now the tariffs also being added that includes the content in those vehicles or the parts that are used to make those vehicles. Well, let's go to the next slide so we can see what the impact is of strong demand and tight supply. Well, make no mistake, its prices are rising. While manufacturers have been very careful since the tariffs have been announced to use language about keeping prices stable, they are really talking about MSRPs and not what consumers actually pay. Consumers pay market prices for new and used vehicles. What they pay in the new market is a function of the asking price from dealers, the negotiated discounts that they end up getting by working with dealers, and net of incentives that manufacturers are willing to provide. Well, as demand surges and supply tightens, microeconomics taught us that prices should go up. And a leading indicator of that is what we have observed in April listing prices. Listing prices for the industry are basically asking prices, and we have observed that they have increased each week since the tariff announcement. And that's pretty abnormal in the vehicle market in either new or used. Keep in mind, these are not tariffed vehicles yet. This is simply the market reacting. It takes a few days after the end of the month for us to really have the full picture of how this played out model by model in real transactions. But we know for a fact that used prices have moved higher. And I guarantee you that consumers who bought new vehicles in April paid more than they did in March, especially when you take into account incentives, which brings us to the next slide. Motor Intelligence and Wards will be reporting on incentives within the next 24 hours that we all measure and pay attention to based on what the OEMs report they spent. We track offers as the month is proceeding, and financing offers are usually a very good proxy for what the trend in incentive spend will be. Well, it looks like the tight supply has produced a seller's market because financing offers are the lowest we've seen since well before the pandemic. There is no need to get aggressive with financing when you don't have much to sell, and frankly, when you also have much higher costs coming down the pipe. So no attractive offers, no urgency. Higher prices, no urgency. No urgency, and we're about to see the market transition again on the other side of this demand frenzy. So if you go to our final slide, we already reduced our forecast that we shared at the end of March, and we see no need to change it for 2025 at this point. But we do see a declining, not growing market. But it's one that the peak for the year is probably just behind us and likely to see slowing as the market transitions from what was fundamental demand of closer to 16.5 million pre-tariffs to what is likely closer to 15 million post-tariffs. There is no free lunch in economics, and that's definitely no free lunch in the vehicle market today. Higher costs either lead to higher prices or lower profits. Lower profits lead to production cuts. Higher prices lead to lower demand. We'll end up with a mix of both, we believe, and that means lower sales are inevitable. It would appear that the first phase of frenzy in the retail vehicle market seems to have already passed, as April is ending with a little less momentum than certainly it began. Meanwhile, uncertainty remains acute, especially regarding what will indeed happen with these tariffs that Aaron covered. Price-motivated buyers, we believe, acted 3 to 4 weeks ago. Supply has since tightened and prices have moved higher, and with higher prices, urgency has diminished. That alone should make it clear that this is not 2021 all over again. Back then, it was the shock from COVID. Now it's the shock from tariffs. COVID strengthened demand for vehicles, not destroying it. Tariffs hurt demand for vehicles, and that includes the tariffs on parts that will lead to higher inflation in repair and maintenance and insurance, which impact every American and not just the people thinking about buying a new imported vehicle. And although we have seen a similar sales surge dynamic this spring compared to 2021 and the early days of COVID, back then demand was supported by $4 trillion in stimulus, record low auto rates and loose credit, a booming economy and labor market, and a red hot housing market that generally creates more demand in the vehicle market. There will be no stimulus in 2025. Rates are near 25-year highs, and the Fed is not coming to the rescue with inflation expected to rise. Credit is tight and not likely to change for the better with such uncertainty and restrictive monetary policy, and the housing market looks more like 2009 than 2021. So I told you last month that the roller coaster ride had begun, and I would generally say we're now at the point where you throw your hands up and hope you don't lose your lunch on the way down. The good news is, if there is good news I can share today, is the next 2 months should prove out how different this year will end up being. And you can count on us to share facts about how this ride proceeds. So with that charming analogy, Jamie, I'll hand it back to you.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, it's first of all, want to remind everyone to put your questions in the queue. Not that I don't want to monopolize all the questions here, but I do want to also get to some of yours. But first, I mean, let me just to draw you out just a little bit more on that. I mean, it's Really interesting. You know, March was such a gangbusters month, and April started off really strong. But it's interesting what you said about the sales momentum slowing throughout the month as the consumer confidence is falling and these other trends. I mean, it's, I know you just cut the outlook for the full year at the end of the first quarter. But this seems like it's adding up to a scenario with some pretty bad, and we just saw first quarter GDP was negative. It seems like this is adding up to a scenario with some pretty bad implications for the rest of the year. Do you, at what point might you need to adjust your outlook again? Would it be in a month or two?
Well, we all focus on an annual number. And so part of the magic when you've had such a frenzy and strength in the first quarter and now into, you know, April's going to be a really solid number. It's, we just think it's going to be slightly down from what it was in March. And that sets you up to, well, if you do the math to end up at a year that we projected to be 15.6 now, that definitely implies a pretty substantial amount of slowing. That probably gets you at least into the low 14s and possibly lower than that before you get really back to what we think the natural market would be with this level of pricing and reduced production is closer to 15, maybe 15.5 at its top. So essentially, we've got to deal with the market radically adjusting from that level to below. But to your point, it also means we have to be talking about the broader effect on the economy. And so all of that talk, and yes, the forecast revision we did was for what we expect to happen, not including a recession. But if part of the mix is that the economy goes into a recession, well, then yes, there's a negative impact on vehicle demand, because when people lose their jobs, that's really when consumer spending and historically where we see the biggest decline always in vehicle purchases. I guess there is a little bit, the scenario modeling that we've done suggests that a recession probably brings sales down closer to 14 million and not worse. And it's because we've never really had a recession before when there is really low supply like we have and a pretty substantial, I would argue, amount of pent-up demand. The problem with the pent-up demand is that it's not capable of buying any vehicle at any price. It's pent-up demand that is highly payment and price sensitive. And so as a result, with tariffs being the real driver of this, the prices are going in the wrong direction. And we don't think this environment is favorable for credit, you know, to fix those issues. So effectively, it just means that we're stuck, with this environment.
Digging into some of the details of the executive order, or one of the two, it was interesting that one of them is tied to the MSRP. And I think, you know, one could argue that that's kind of an artificial number that automakers can set as they please. Is this open to manipulation? Can they game the system by maybe bumping up the MSRP and offering some incentives that would counteract that, but let them capture more chargebacks, offsets?
Sure. I mean, why not? Of course they could, but OEMs to this point right now have said that they're actually not touching MSRPs. And some of them have declared going into June that they're not touching the MSRPs. Ford even just said today they're not touching MSRPs on any May-built vehicles. So I think consumers are still highly sensitive to MSRPs. And I do believe that that is where a lot of consumers might be looking to see evidence of tariff increases in costs, because we've been sort of coaching individuals on how to especially look at their Monroney labels to see what their content is and things like this. So I think we do have a consumer that's getting a little bit more aware of how to look at the pricing of a vehicle and the assembly of a vehicle. That said, absolutely. I mean, if, you know, at the end of the day, the customer is sensitive to the payment amount, to what their insurance is going to be, their monthly expenditures, and not always to the grand price of the vehicle. So it could be a way that they manipulate it. It has to be an aggregate number of the vehicles that are sold in the U.S. So it does need to take into account, of course, for manufacturers that are also importing vehicles, because, again, not every vehicle is actually assembled in the U.S.
Yeah, I really don't see this as a great opening for manufacturers to play games with the MSRP. Because one, as Aaron was mentioning, they've been very careful and they know that the White House and consumers alike are paying attention to what is happening with the MSRPs. But I'll also raise the issue that MSRPs at the end of the day are very key to measuring the residual and are key to the dynamics of understanding loan to value on the vehicle and in financing, which is 80% of the transactions that occur. So when you start contemplating potentially monkeying with the MSRP, you also really bring in credit challenges and the like that I don't think manufacturers are willing to open up that bottle, that Pandora's box, to cause more problems. So I think the action is going to be this distinction that I'm trying to draw out that, well, the MSRPs may not change, but what consumers are really paying in the short term may spike, but that's probably not going to last over the longer term. And the real action is going to be how do some of the costs get passed along? How does it relate to the decisions for model by model? And we think that action is really going to play out at the segment level.
Have you looked at specific models that'll be most impacted or have the biggest impact maybe on the overall market? I mean, like the RAV4 is made in largely in Canada. A lot of pickups come from Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that. Certainly, we've kept an eye on the top five most impacted models, and we based that on 2024 volume sales. And if we had multiplied that out, if the tariff had been applied last year. And so that was the Chevy Equinox, the Chevy... the Honda HR-V, Honda CR-V, Subaru Forester, and Chevy Equinox and Chevy Trax. And so those four models are some of, I mean, by very virtue of the fact that they were the largest volume that would have been impacted the most given their import percentages. We've actually seen sales for all of those jump up, prices being held on those, supplies going down in all five of those. So it's evident that, you know, whether it's that people were pulling ahead truly because of those specific models or otherwise they just knew, like compact SUVs is another segment. Every single compact SUV will be impacted in some way from a tariff perspective. So it's across the board where there are lower and less expensive vehicles available to the consumers. Typically they're lower and less expensive because they are manufactured outside of the US. So again, yesterday's actions don't really help a ton with those types of models. Chevy Trax coming over from Korea, and we heard from GM this morning, them speaking to that effect. So we're still going to see a real crunch on vehicles that are actually affordable, quote unquote, from an average transaction price perspective.
Speaking of average transaction prices, you have those charts were really great, but they were mostly directional, not like hyper-labeled. Which is useful for the side screen run. I'm not complaining, but we have a question from the audience. Can you share the numbers for like ATPs in January and April, and if you know, an outlook going forward?
Sure, I can. While we're talking, pull up what we see or have seen with the ATPs. We've generally really didn't see price changes in the first quarter. Prices were relatively flat month to month, but the Kelley Blue Book average transaction price started the year at, let me, here we go, January 48,145. That was a decline from a peak for last year, which is usually the case in December. You've got strong demand, you've got fully represented new models driving a lot of the increases. So we'd hit 49,768 in December. We fell to 48,145 in January. We actually then saw further declines, modest declines each month in February and March, to March's number being 47,462. And that was a 0.2% change from the month before. And really what's happening in, at the beginning of the year is less about more discounting. Discounting's been relatively stable. It's more a mix of vehicles, more lower price vehicles have been in the transaction. And correspondingly, one of the biggest ironies that I saw in the first quarter is we saw more subprime buyers buying vehicles too, which correlates with that mix being softer in the first quarter. As I mentioned, that data also tells us that discounting was stable in the last 2 months of the year. So consumers have generally been seeing about a 4% discount relative to MSRP. And that has been going up from premiums being paid over MSRP back in 2021 now, you know, looks like it was sort of stabilizing last year at 4%. And then incentives have been increasing over the last several years from all-time lows back during the supply chain challenges. We had a modest decrease in incentives in March, and it was really because I think the surge and frenzy in the last 5 days of the month didn't really materially change the offers. It's really April that I would expect that number to be a big decline. So incentives were still up year over year, 5% in March in our Kelley Blue Book data. And I suspect they will be down year over year when we get the April numbers done.
You mentioned the mix by price, the demand for the more affordable vehicles kind of skewing things down. Going forward, do you anticipate that automakers will refocus and shift their production to the high cost, you know, high MSRP vehicles to maximize, you know, try to maximize profits by hitting at a higher price point, as Gary asked, you know, maximize their domestic production capacity a la the COVID approach?
I mean, one of the things that's interesting is when we were looking at the dynamics of supply over the last few weeks, pickups and large SUVs are the ones that aren't dwindling in supply as much. So that would lead you to believe we've already got plenty of supply in those areas right now. It's not, you know, those are still price sensitive, you know, expensive vehicles. But the challenge is that those vehicles that are less expensive are the more popular and high volume vehicles that get entry into the brand, and it's highly competitive. So I can't imagine that most automakers are willing to cede share across the board by not having either the available inventory or pricing themselves out of their competitive set. And I think that's really the dynamic we're going to continue to see play out over the next few months is this, as I've called it, sort of a market share bonanza. Just how do each of these manufacturers look across their segment and say, how do I think about competitors I typically haven't thought about cross-shopping, and how do I promote my vehicle that might be less expensive than this other vehicle over here, especially if supply is starting to drop on those imported vehicles. And let's say you might have a domestic version or a less expensive version, or your portfolio in general is more protected and therefore you can afford to take the hit on the lower cost vehicles. So I struggle to believe that they're not going to continue to focus on the more affordable cars, whether they're able to move a lot of those here to the U.S. or not. Assembly is certainly the easier thing to do than parts. And a lot of, you know, investments continue to come out. So it's anyone's guess. It's really going to be a manufacturer by manufacturer decision. I don't think there's going to be one solid answer across the industry.
And I'll go back to the earlier theme that I mentioned. The action's going to be at the segment level because you assess your competition at the segment level. Price elasticity is majorly different at the segment level. So what's possible to pass along and what the consumer can actually handle will be a part of that discussion and how important that is to their global portfolio, you know, in some cases. So that's where we're going to see the big changes, I think.
So affordability, you know, with the vehicle prices and the lending rates has been a big limiting constraint on auto sales. Tariffs can only make that worse, right? How do you try to quantify that?
Well, we quantify it every month in partnership with Moody's Analytics, where we do the math on what the prices and incentives and income levels and rates are dictating. And ironically, yes, affordability limits the market and has been a key reason why we've been under 16 for the last couple of years. But we've been making great progress. I mean, affordability has improved every month, almost every single month sequentially for 2 years as prices have come down. Well, really, the two variables that have worked in favor of consumers are solid income growth and then prices coming down. So tariffs start to ruin that by two ways. Prices going up, which our forecasts and others are generally saying, both new and used, should go up roughly 5%. We think that's That's a function of all the calculation of all the costs in the past, what's possible to pass along, what the market dynamics are going to do. Net effect is prices are going up, but not going up like we had in 2021, because there's a limit to it. So obviously, if prices are going up, that's bad. But if the whole tariff picture is changing the labor market dynamics, and worse, we have a recession, then the positive income story becomes the greater at risk. And then I'll raise the question that I'm most worried about with this parts tariff is the fact that it impacts every American through insurance and through repair and maintenance. And I think all of us are going to have to reconstitute what we use as affordability metrics to include the cost of insurance, because I think the cost of insurance is going to become a gateway threshold that becomes as important as the quote unquote loan monthly payment has been historically, because this is going to send insurance rates continuing skyward. And we know that insurance is already an impediment to purchase activity.
Really good point. Thank you for that. Another question from the audience. GM said they estimate tariffs will take a $4 to $5 billion bite out of 2025 earnings, less 30% for offsets, unidentified offsets, but it plans to not raise MSRPs over the tariffs. Do you anticipate that Ford or maybe Stellantis would match that pledge? And if they do, is there a risk that ATPs will potentially be above MSRP on some GM models or anyone else who, you know, commits to holding the line at beginning of the year prices?
Well, we already heard Ford said that they're not going to raise their MSRPs in the immediate future. So I would imagine that they're going to try to stay neck and neck with what their competitors are doing. And I would imagine that Stellantis and Chrysler will, you know, quickly follow suit in that. And remember that Stellantis is a little bit of an odd duck because they have so many different brands that are also available in foreign markets. So they're doing some other mental calculus that all of us can't think of that's not typical for the domestic manufacturers as well. So, and they've got, you know, inventory still built up from last year. So they've got a little flexibility there. So we'll see what they do. But I don't imagine, again, in this competitive environment, that any of the automakers are not going to try to hold price alongside their segment competitors.
What about other ways to raise prices? I mean, we've already seen destination charges like double or triple over the last 10 years. Can those go up? And it seemed like VW, which did say they were going to identify them, almost sounded like they were going to put the tariff costs in the destination charge because it basically happens as a product of shipping.
I mean, if they want to not make their dealer body terribly happy, because of course then it escapes margin. You know, they haven't come out saying it much more about that. So I imagine that they're still trying to work out how are they going to, you know, are they really going to put it in a destination charge? How does that then get financed? How does it get calculated against the total value of the vehicle? I suspect if no one else does it, they're not going to do it. We heard, you know, just as an analog example, yesterday, what happened to Amazon? You know, we're going to put the tariff charges on here. And by the end of the day, nope, they're not going to be there. And that's a much broader market, right? That's Chinese inventory coming over. And so I can't imagine that Volkswagen's going to poke the bear in that way, given the dynamics right now.
One more follow-up on prices. Sorry, we've gotten a bunch from the audience. And sorry, Jonathan, if you had more you wanted to add, but throw this in the mix too. I mean, we're really only a few months away from summer changeover. So maybe they can hold the line on prices through the 2025 model year, but maybe we'll see a recalibration for 2026. Is that something that's reasonable to expect?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to, I mean, first of all, we typically see that happen anyway in the pricing dynamics for newer models. And because we will be lower on supply, theoretically, of the 25s, so, you know, we've been in cases last year, especially with some brands, where we were sitting on a lot of 20, you know, year before inventory and needing to move that, the dust off the metal there. And I don't think we're going to be in that same dynamic. So I think they're going to have a little bit more freedom to look at pricing for 2026 model year. But it's still going to be a matter of what the mix is available on the ground at the dealership. And will they even have, you know, when will the 26 start rolling off, depending on whether they're imported or produced here? Have they started to slow down some of that production? So we might not even see that until August, September, and then how is that impacted by what's happening in the market at large, like Jonathan's been speaking to.
Yeah, I think we're more likely to see some MSRP changes with the model year, but I think the real action is going to be in what the consumer is actually paying net of incentives, as well as the invoice. I think the invoice is where we're going to see a lot more movement, and we're preparing to really look at that even in the month of April.
So, couple of questions bundled up together in one. The new car buyers tend to be quite affluent, really top quintile, top quartile earners. Is there any insight into their sentiment as consumers versus other demographics? Obviously, the stock market's taken a hit, but maybe they don't feel as vulnerable on other inflation.
So in the consumer sentiment data, we from Morning Consult, they look at it by income tier and political party, all of the, and the declines that we've seen, particularly over the last 30 to 45 days, have been across the board. But in the last couple of weeks, the highest income cohort has started going back up again. And along with that, very interestingly, as you would guess, we pay attention to vehicle purchase intentions in their data. And purchase intention net is down dramatically, but it's being driven by median income and lower income households. And what we're actually seeing as sentiment is improving for higher income consumers is their purchase intention is not down, it's still high. So that bodes well, I guess, for the luxury end of the segment. I was more worried about that a month ago when it looked like we had a full-on 20% more stock correction and the negative wealth effect that you would expect from that. But clearly, yes, it's the affordability story is about the total market and really about the median income consumer. But the market has shifted to be very dependent on the top two income quintiles. And, news story, there is no affordability problem in the in those segments. Hence why handling a 20% increase in costs theoretically when part of the reason is to lower somebody's income tax rate, it probably net net isn't going to be a challenge to the market longer term, assuming you don't destroy the economy in the process and wipe a quarter of market value off at the same time. So I do think it is worthy of asking those questions and paying attention to the dynamics. We probably are destined to a market that becomes even more concentrated and dependent on those very consumers. That means a smaller market, but that means a market probably that is a little less volatile from a credit perspective and other things historically that have caused some of the ebbs and flows that we see.
We're just about out of time, but we still have a ton of questions. Are either of you available to stay for a few more minutes? See if we can get a couple more in.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. If Aaron, I know you've got a flight to catch. If you need to drop, just say goodbye and
I'm okay.
we'll
Yeah.
carry on as best
I've
we
got two
can.
more of these before I get to catch my flight, so
Okay,
don't you
good.
worry.
Okay, great. I know you guys focus more on the consumer market than the production side, but is there a sense that production is made vulnerable by this by the parts tariffs kicking in? At one point, it had been thought maybe there could be widespread shutdowns within a week or two. Does it look like that's going to be avoidable? Certainly, GM's guidance today seems to think they think this is manageable.
I mean, my take on it would be, again, pretty specific to which lines you're talking about, which vehicles you're talking about, what they're relying upon. It is key to note that the suppliers still are not getting the relief here directly. So it would be up to an OEM or an automaker to pass on that 3.75% offset at some point. And it's still the case that all suppliers and automakers have to have the money available on record when the good crosses the border because the tariff is still in place. This is just an offset right now from a parts perspective. So I anticipate that we'll continue to hear from MEMA and other, industry resources around the suppliers say that this is continues to be a challenge for financial stability for our tier two and tier three suppliers and being able to finance the cost of A, either changing over their production to the US if it's even possible, which we think the parts transference here, reshoring here is a lot more difficult than the assembly. But there's also other things like the rare earth minerals that are being threatened. You know, we think of those very much in terms of EVs, but they are also really important in componentry and coatings and things like this. And so there are other elements that could really disrupt our supply chain still to come. And it's not just tariffs. You know, it's we keep saying, I don't want to be an automaker right now in the sense that you got a lot of dynamics you're managing through. And it's not just tariffs, even though that's what we're all focused on, because it's a pretty big bullseye. So yeah, I anticipate that we will still hear of challenges, even if the automakers in their quarterly earnings aren't making it sound that stressful.
And we still are uncertain about some of the mechanics of how this is going to be actually
right.
handled.
Implemented. Yeah.
How do you inspect, assess, and charge and collect the tariff? That alone could be disruptive, certainly adding time and inefficiencies to the process. And that's really where I think the worry is going to unfold, you know, as we see the disruption taking place. We think that some of these moves with the credits, et cetera, are an attempt to more directly deal with the OEMs in the way that this is being billed and collected, and sort of hint that it could be a little less disruptive and more efficient in that regard. But we're not going to know for certain until we actually hear what's happening.
Jonathan, wondering if you have a Schoolhouse Rock version of price elasticity?
I saw that question.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'll have to work on that one, but you know, it is
maybe something with the Spinner's Rubber Band Man would be good.
Yes. Yes. Well, I've got a song list of now up to 50 songs that have been contributed by lots of people in the industry to deal with the tariffs. But I'm sure there's one or two of them that might directly relate to it. But elasticity is essentially, to what degree do price changes impact the actual demand? So when you're perfectly inelastic, it basically means people are going to still keep buying you because they absolutely need you to exist. And the vehicle market is not perfectly inelastic. Well, on the perfectly elastic side, you know, every small change in price would have a dramatic decline in volumes. And we're not quite there either. Where we really see things as being different is the analogy to 2021. I would argue that the vehicle became central to what was most important to consumers back then. You were avoiding public transportation. You were moving to further out places. You were no longer commuting every day and living in the compact sedan and more contemplating the larger SUV that was better for the family trip to the beach twice a year. You know, you had all of these things happening. And then you also juiced demand by having you know, record low interest rates, loosest credit possible, and $4 trillion being sent out to people's pocketbooks. So demand was unusually strengthened and enabled, which effectively made we had no elasticity. There was no sensitivity because there was somebody that was willing to pay whatever price just to get that vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that now. We have, I would argue, the exact opposite, with the exception of like the luxury end of the market. And if we navigate things without a recession, then I do think we could see some of the cost absorption taking place and much more stability in that part of the market, where credit, doing things like with leasing and all, become, you know, a straightforward way to make this a virtuous cycle and supporting. But where you have real challenges are in the affordable price points, because there, I would argue, that's where the maximum elasticity is, meaning a 1% increase in costs could take away 10% of the market. That kind of volume change and sensitivity really will force some manufacturers to decide, can we make it in this segment? Is it worth making in this segment in terms of our global platform, et cetera? And I think at last count, don't we have 20 vehicles in that category, Aaron? I wouldn't.
Yep.
I would definitely expect less than half of those models to exist if we see the tariffs remain permanent.
All right, let's do one last multi-part type question. You know, there's been, in light of the affordability challenges and the challenge of trying to buy any kind of vehicle for the middle part of the market, There's a lot of excitement around the slate unveiling, and I think related to that, is there a chance that automakers would, offer add fewer features, fewer bells and whistles in order to keep prices down and reach more consumers? Or again, it's sort of that play versus the sort of COVID play of just going upscale. I guess maybe it depends by segment. How do you look at that?
Yeah. I mean, here's what I would say about the slate. First and foremost, I think we just have to remember the reach of which that got exposure. So I'm not sure that I can count on those consumers that were looking for a vehicle $20,000 to $25,000 are necessarily paying attention to the hottest influencers in our media round the clock coverage of everything. So how realistic an EV that can only go 150 miles on range and has roll down windows and no screens. The interesting thing about that is that, yes, I mean, car makers for a while now have said, and I've talked about it plenty of times, that part of the affordability challenge is the pickiness of US consumers and the desire to have the car built the way you want it built with all the bells and whistles. We saw a lot of this really come through with some of the Korean manufacturers when they came over. I mean, we were just all sort of blown away by how highly equipped these vehicles were, but yet they were more affordable. So I think that consumers have really ratcheted up their expectations, which then, of course, causes complexity for the automakers to build these vehicles to spec. And that's why we see excess inventory around the country that we've got to move around because we've guessed wrong, right? And so I think any automaker out there is realistically looking for ways to cut down costs, whether it really comes at the sacrifice of some software technology or newest mechanics that everyone is expecting to see on vehicles these days. I would think it's going to come more from a lot of that consolidation you're seeing under the hood. So the sharing of technologies or hardwares and things like that, they're going to try to find cost efficiencies that way more than trimming down vehicles. I think the other situation is that those individuals might, and this is just me speaking what I think about human behavior and consumers, individuals that are coming into the market with lower budgets typically are coming in from a used vehicle. And depending on how old that used vehicle is, we do have to remember that expectations on technology may not be as advanced as we think they need to be. And car makers would be smart to think about that. So when they're thinking about dialing back some of those expensive trim packages or software or hardware developments, to remember who is the customer that's likely jumping in at that range. I think everyone thinks it's a Gen Zer who's been a digital native. And, I would question how many individuals in that age range are truly coming into the new car market. And if they are, they're likely getting paid for by a parent somewhere, something like that. I think it's a great time for automakers to really rethink how they plan their products and how they find efficiencies. And I've said it a couple times before, like we're at over 620 variants in this country. We used to be before electrification came in, we were in the 400s. That was still insane. So, I mean, there's a lot of room, I think, here for manufacturers to get pretty laser focused on what's really selling, what do they really need for their clientele, and certainly a way for them to dial back some of the costs.
Yeah, I totally agree. Reinforce enormous opportunity. There is tremendous white space available. And absolutely think about the consumer who for affordability is realistically only considering used, and within used is having to consider a 6 to 10 year old or even older vehicle in order to make that payment work. So a bare bones vehicle actually would be compelling, absolutely compelling, I think. So I'm all for seeing someone attempt to do that. And I think you'll see success. May not be with the Gen Zers, but I know some crotchety old Gen Xers and boomers that would.
I think we have some on our team,
right? Vehicles. Yeah. Maybe.
Bring the 5 speed back.
For sure. All right. Well, we have enough questions. We could do a whole Labor Day telethon kind of thing, but we've got to let you go. We've got to let everyone get back to work. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Thanks to Jim Martino for producing. Thanks to Kevin Singer, APA President Kaylee Hall, and the rest of the APA board for pulling together this series. Thanks especially to our terrific guests, Jonathan Smoke, Chief Economist at Cox Automotive, Aaron Keating, Executive Analyst at Cox Automotive. I'm Jamie Butters. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks for having us. Take care.